Welcome to Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. In a world where talking about the impact of money is difficult, we share stories and tips for reducing the negative impact that significant wealth can have on our emotions, relationships, and behaviors. Now here's your host, Ginny Galisonow.
Welcome, everyone. Today we have with us Charlie Bantis. Charlie is the president of the Aspen branch of First Western Trust, and he was a former regional president of Vectra Bank. Good morning, Charlie. Thank you for being with us today.
Good morning, Ginny. Thank you, and it's my pleasure.
Good. I'm glad to have you. So let's begin with a description of what your role is at First Western Trust and the services offered by you and your company.
Okay. My official role is market president, meaning that I'm responsible for all the aspects of the performance of our 2.5-year-old office. Really, though, it's my job to ensure that we provide our clients the kind of products and, more importantly, the service they need in order to meet their individual goals. And I help our staff do that every way I can. So it's really, my job is to facilitate meeting the needs of our clients.
As you know, I often find myself redefining what I consider to be the true meaning of wealth. And to me, that includes one's human, social, spiritual, intellectual, and financial capitals. One of the reasons that I have been drawn to First Western Trust has been your company's core beliefs around wealth, which is what I think makes you unique in the world of finance. Could you tell us more about these values, how your company came to adopt them, and their impact on your clients?
We really share a belief in the same value system that you do, which is that wealth encompasses not just your bank account, your stock portfolio, your emotional wealth, your spiritual wealth, your family wealth, kind of everything that makes us people, makes us individuals. And we came to this through a process of working with our clients, speaking to our clients, observing them as they're going through the opportunities and challenges that wealth brings. Those people who worked hard their lives and suddenly had a life-changing financial event, sale of the company, something like that, almost were never prepared for it. Financially, they were probably pretty well prepared for it, though sometimes not even then. But emotionally, they never stopped to consider the effect on their families. They never stopped to consider the effect even on their own lives. Now, all of a sudden, they have the ability to do so many things. And we saw them frequently be the deer in the headlights. They just didn't know what to do. So over time, this concept evolved of helping them connect what they believe in, what they want to do, things that are important to them, to their financial wealth, and to help them make that bridge and so they can actually feel good about what they're doing and be comfortable with it.
So Aspen is a unique community, and you have been part of the Aspen financial community for almost 20 years? It's a long time to be here in Aspen. What have been some of the challenges your clients have brought to you?
I would say, without question, the most unique challenge was the Bernie Madoff disaster. That affected, by my count, well over 100 people and families here in the Valley.
Wow.
And many of them lost everything. They had to sell their homes. They went from being very comfortable and wealthy to starting over again, many of them in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. Compounding all of this was the fact that many of them considered Bernie Madoff a friend, a trusted advisor, the feeling of betrayal, absolute betrayal, was bitter and deep, and in many cases, I think, made a rational approach to solving the issues almost impossible. We had some who were clients, and they found themselves all of a sudden without the income they'd been relying on to support other investments, support their lifestyle. And there were loan defaults, there were foreclosures. Of course, all of this was happening during the recession as well. further compounding the issues. It was just an unmitigated disaster for everyone involved. And I don't know how many people realize how deeply a big part of this community was affected.
Yes, I continue to run into people who are still devastated by what happened to them. They have still not recovered financially and definitely not emotionally. I think that sense of betrayal, if somebody was your friend, can just be, well, it's the worst.
And I think too, and I remember hearing this so often from these folks, because as their banker, I would look year after year at these really relatively outsized and incredibly stable returns they were getting from the Madoff investments. And I would ask them about it. And I'd say, boy, everything you've got is there. And yeah, the history looks great. Shouldn't you consider a little diversification maybe? It was Madoff and real estate. That was the majority of it, Madoff and real estate. And the answer I'd get was, no, Bernie is great. Bernie's been doing this for years. It's wonderful. And the lesson there is, if it something is too good to be true, it probably is, and diversification.
So, as you know, one of the services I provide to my clients is in helping families have the difficult conversations about this most taboo subject, the emotional impact of significant wealth. How does this type of service align with and complement the needs of your clients? And, you know, for that matter, I'm wondering even if some of the value work I have done in the past with clients could have influenced some of the decisions that some of the Madoff investors had made to stay with him long term.
It's possible. It is possible. I think that's a case-by-case discussion, obviously, but from the people I know who were directly affected by it, I think several of them might possibly have made some different decisions, or at least mitigated their exposures in other ways had they been thinking about other aspects than just the, you know, Bernie's my friend and Bernie does a great job for me. It was really a very limited thought process to it, which unfortunately most people still have toward wealth. But one of the things, and again, this goes back to a little bit to what I was saying before, most people who create the wealth, and I'm thinking of a couple of real examples right now, really, they spent their life focused on building it, building a company, working hard, however they've done it. They tend to exclude the other aspects of life, not to say they exclude their family, they don't pay attention to their family or anything like that, but they really don't think about what happens when I achieve it. You know, it's the old joke about someone stopping the car when the dog is chasing it and turning around and saying, okay, now you've got it, what are you going to do? I don't know that people think that one through. So one of the things we do is help them think about it. And I have a real life example here. We have several clients who are fairly wealthy and don't have children and don't necessarily want to leave a tremendous amount of money or assets to relatives, nieces, nephews, things like that. One fellow in particular, just in a conversation one day, said he'd always had an affinity for veterans and first responders and would love to figure out some way to help them. Well, we have a service where we will go and if someone gives us reasonable direction, we will go and research and vet various charitable organizations in a given field. And in this case, it was first responders and veterans. And we did that for him. And now he has a nice list of vetted organizations that he wants to go talk to and do and speak with and learn a little more about and make his decisions. Then the next steps come of setting up, changing his will, setting up a trust, things like that. But he knew he wanted to do something. He just didn't know how to go about it and frankly didn't really have the time. So that's the sort of thing that we will help people with and also help. Sometimes we're counselors. We just sit and listen to, boy, how do we do this? How do we want our children to understand their wealth? And do we want to curse them with it or bless them with it? That's an actual quote from a client.
It's an accurate quote.
It is.
Curse or bless. You know, there has been some history of other wealth and legacy coaches like me actually asking a room full of clients, of well, beneficiaries, how do they feel about having an inherited trust? Do they think it's a burden or a blessing? And oftentimes, 70% of the room will raise their hands and say, it's a burden. It's a real burden. And for those who have never experienced this phenomenon, they really don't understand how that possibly could be true.
Well, we hear that too. And in fact, we think some of us think the number is much closer to 85 or 90%. But anyway, you know, that gets into the question of why is it a burden? And that is because the trusts tend to be written by the creator of the wealth or the previous generation. And there wasn't a lot of good communication back and forth about what they really wanted. You know, the perception of a child at 19 is very different than that person at 39. And unfortunately, that trust may have been written when that the beneficiary was a high school or college student. And there's a very limiting view there. Our view towards trust and the beneficiaries is a pretty simple precept. It's not our money. It's their money. And to the absolute extent possible, we still have to be governed by the trust, but to the absolute extent possible, our philosophy is generally to interpret that trust and help those beneficiaries and give them what they want, what they're asking for. It's not our job to just arbitrarily say no.
You know, one of the things that I have encountered is because trusts are written, as you said, like when they're 19 years old, because it's kind of the first, one of the things that happens the first time you hear about your inheritance is the creation of the next trust so that you could pass it on to the next generation. But then the other thing that I do encounter is that beneficiaries will start to feel that their trustee is more of a gatekeeper as opposed to a friend or a mentor. In some cases, it's almost as if this trustee has replaced their parent and they don't even know this old, ancient attorney who is now the trustee, who is the gatekeeper. And I've often heard trustees say, well, it's not their money, it's my money, which is a fascinating statement for a beneficiary to hear.
And legally and factually wrong, I might add as well. You know, that comes back to our concept of what we do and how we work with clients. We are, in fact, a full-service commercial bank, as well as an asset manager, as well as a trustor. We want to do a lot of things with our client, and we can do a lot of things with our clients. They're not limited to just the trust manager as their contact. They might have me or one of my peers across our system, or a lender, an asset manager. That helps take away the, I think, autocratic approach of many trust departments. Also, too, like I go back to what I said. I have a great true story of our recently retired trust manager who once went down to Texas to visit a prospective client, and he was the third of three prospective trust managers she interviewed. She brought him out to a little garden in the back of her house and said, you know, I want to make some improvements here. It's going to cost $5,000 or $6,000. You know, what would you say about that? Well, apparently the first person she interviewed said, looks fine to me. I don't know why I need to do anything.
Oh, gosh.
The second, and this is a true story. The second one said, well, you know, we'll you have to give us the request in writing. We'll bring it to our trust committee and maybe in a month or 5 weeks, we'll have an answer and a check a few weeks after that if the answer is yes. Bill's response was, I'll have a check cut for you Monday.
I love it. You know, one of the things that I actually do with clients is I work with them on creating what I refer to as a purposeful legacy. And within that purposeful legacy, it includes language as a letter to the trustee. You know, this is what I really want, my intention behind this gift of inheritance to my child. It also includes what some people refer to as a letter from heaven and the ethical will, which is more about your identifying your values and your mission and things like that. I wonder, in your experience, if somebody came to you with this purposeful legacy document to accompany the trust, how much more effective would your trust officers be at administering and managing the trust?
I think they'd be a lot more effective. It would add flesh and muscle on the bone of the trust agreement, which necessarily have to be drawn in a very legalistic and written in a very legalese kind of way. But the accompanying letter document saying, here's what I really want to have happen, here's why I want it to have happen, provides the guidance. I think it would be even more effective if the beneficiary, the trustor, the trustee can all sit in the room when the trust is opened up and it's being signed and have the real discussion around that. And everybody walk away with the same understanding as well. I don't think that happens nearly often enough.
Yes, I would agree. I would agree.
You're listening to Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. For more information, visit our website, dynamicsoffamilywealth.com. And now back to the show.
So, Charlie, earlier you referred to the fact that you had a number of clients who did not have children, who were then having to face the whole issue of what do I do with all of this money? I too have a couple clients who do not have children, and they do not really understand what their role is with respect to the nieces and nephews for whom they're concerned about, where there's sort of an assumption their money is going to the nieces and nephews, and they do not want to put it all in philanthropy. And they're struggling with to whom do they pass on all of this money that they now have. Have you encountered that, and how have you handled it?
I have not personally encountered that situation, but I think it's analogous to the situation where someone comes into real life-changing wealth, maybe unexpectedly, maybe not, but then there are the spoken and unspoken demands from family members for support and assistance, and how do you deal with that? How do you deal with hearing from cousins you haven't spoken with in 15, 20 years who are coming out of the woodwork asking or not asking, implying for loans, quote unquote? You know, I think that's an interesting question. If you have a niece and nephew, if you are so fortunate to be in this position and your siblings are not, do you want to? First of all, I mean, let's just be honest about it. Do you really want to do that? What is your relationship with your siblings?
The other question that I've had posed to me is I'm just the uncle or the aunt, and I'm not the parent, but my sister, my brother, they're not doing anything to prepare their children, my niece, my nephew, for the receipt of the money that they're going to inherit from my sister or brother. And now, in addition to that enormous wealth, they're going to get all of my inheritance, and I don't know what my role is. And that's one of the things that I've actually had to work with people on, is how do you become comfortable with passing on money when you're not the parent of a recipient?
Again, I've not had how have you handled it? What's the range of response you have come across with that?
Well, you know, interestingly, what we've done first is we have worked on them. So I do a lot of family retreats where we talk about the family wealth mission statement and identifying what their core values are and work-related values are. So what I do first is I really have worked with the clients, the person without children, to determine where they are with respect to the money. And then to start sharing that information with their sister and brother, or even the nephew in family, you know, in times when they take the nephew out on a special trip, or dinner. So it's kind of like happened almost by osmosis. And I've also had situations where they have quite honestly gone to the sister and the brother and said, this is going to happen. I'm uncomfortable. I'm not their parent, but I do not want to be a contributor to something that could have a disastrous effect on somebody. Can I do this? Can I talk to your children about that? And in many cases, surprisingly, when they hear that that person has done the work themselves, then the sister and brother have said, wow, and they can see the impact it's had. So far, several times, they have already said, let's go ahead and do this as a family.
Good. That's got to be the best way to handle it. You know, some people just are saying, in the case, in one particular case I mentioned, this is inherited wealth. The fellow's brother is all as wealthy as he is. And his rationale, as much as he loves his niece and nephew, is they're already going to inherit a lot of money. I don't need to leave them any money. In the case where it's a sibling has done very well and the others just have normal lives, much more complicated. And there are probably some tricks and some, I said not tricks, strategies on the trust side to help ease those kids into it over time. You know, delayed payouts, things like that, matching payouts, matching 50% of a salary up to some number, things like that. But the best thing is what is doing what you do, coaching the family through it, helping them have these conversations and uncover emotional issues, some, I'll bet, dating back to childhood from time to time, that could get in the way of this working properly and smoothly.
Yes, I totally agree with you. One of the things I have encountered is that because nice people don't talk about money, mm-hmm. where they feel safe talking about money is when they come to their financial advisor, because you're the financial advisor. You're supposed to do that. But I have had people say, I wish we had talked to you first to figure out what our values are and who we are. And then we could go to someone who could help us. Fortunately, when they come to someone like you, you get it. There are a lot of financial advisors and estate planners out there in the world who are so much more from the protectionist perspective and do not really understand the importance of having those deeper, meaningful conversations about values and things like that, and the whole arena or dimension of wealth, and not just the money.
Well, and it's important, but we have to wait for the cue from our clients. Some clients really want to segregate that, and they're happy to open up with you on issues, but with us, it's, how am I doing? And that's fine. You know, we have a role, and our role is a little different for everybody.
And thank goodness, right?
Thank God.
I mean, thank God. Thank God that we're experts in our own field.
Right? Yeah, I do not have any sort of degree in psychology or counseling, and nor do I want one.
Right. So. Yeah, and I've taken a couple courses in finance, and I have to admit, there are many times I go, oh my God, I don't know what they're talking about.
But it is important. We had a meeting recently with a client who was having yet another liquidity event, and one of his children was involved in this meeting, and it was really all about setting up lifetime income for the family, children, grandchildren. And it was an interesting meeting because, you know, the daughters, who are 50s, give or take, definitely started taking control of some things, and they frankly needed to. And I thought that was a good thing, and the parents were understanding of it. It was actually a good thing to see and an interesting thing to watch, and very positive for that family.
I love it. You know, I often hear, is it too early or too late to have these conversations? And what you just shared is it really is never too late.
I think the parents had done a very good job over the course of the years with their kids and money, and so there was no surprise. There was no, wow, what does this mean? It was more of a, okay, we all generally agree on these goals. How do we go about getting there?
So, Charlie, you know, I like to leave our listeners with a small or big action step that they can take away and implement on their own. Is there a last word of wisdom you'd like to share?
I think the thing I'd like people to remember, and the one thing that strikes me is that, and we forget it, all of us forget it at times, but money is not, money is a means to an end. it is not the end itself. If money is the end itself for you, then I would suggest you get out more often. But seriously, money is a means to an end. Why, when we work so hard, we invest, we try and do the right things, what are we doing it for? Just keep that in mind. What are you doing it for?
So, Charlie, thank you again. Thank you for your wisdom, your wonderful stories, which I know so many of our listeners will be able to relate to. And for all of our listeners, I look forward to being with you again during our next podcast. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. For more information on this podcast or guidance for having more meaningful conversations around inherited or sudden wealth, please visit our website at dynamicsoffamilywealth.com.